This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, the poet may love them, but who are they anyway? Beatrice, the Dark Lady, Maud Gunn. The love interests of Dante, Shakespeare, and Yeats may live on in our minds, but what do we know about them from the poems? Not much at all, really. Austin Allen has a piece up on our website that takes a close look at why the immortal beloveds of poets have such a nominal ghostly presence in the poems. Austin Allen is an essayist and a poet. His first collection, called Pleasures of the Game, is coming out this fall. He lives in Baltimore, where he joins me from WYPR. Austin, I've always felt sorry for the lovers and spouses of fiction writers, because you just know that in one guise or another, they're probably going to end up in a short story or a novel.
Right.
But you seem to be implying in your essay that the lovers of poets have little to worry about.
Less to worry about.
Less to worry about, because they're not going to get into the details.
Yes, and it's hard to generalize across all love poetry, but across a lot of the most famous love poetry, at least in the English poetic tradition, that lovers seem to have a ghostlier presence in the poems.
Why is that? So why does fiction really draw out to embarrassing detail lovers and spouses and so on of the writers, but not poets? Why not?
Well, I spent a lot of the essay thinking about this and considering this. There might be a few reasons. One is that the lyric genre tends to, you know, foreground the poet's voice and the poet's consciousness, sometimes at the expense of whomever they might be talking about or even to in the poem, in a way that the novel, which is a more social form, you know, it incorporates dialogue and that sort of thing, it has an easier time creating characters, fully rounded characters, than does the lyric.
So Shakespeare can write, "So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee." In other words, this poem. Yeah, we don't know who he's writing to particularly, right? We don't know anything about that person.
No, despite all the, 400 years of scholarship trying to nail down that that question, we don't.
And an even better example from Shakespeare: "Not marble nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme, but you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time." Now, that's great poetry, but again, we don't know who the hell he's talking to.
It's true, and not only do we not know the literal identity, which is, you know, something that could easily get lost over 400 years, I would argue that the sonnets don't even tell us that much about, you know, other than the broad outlines of the young man or the woman that he's talking about, either in the case of the so-called fair youth or the so-called dark lady.
Mm-hmm. But they do tell us a lot about Shakespeare's feelings, or the poet's feelings, or his imagined feelings. They tell us quite a bit about him.
They do, although some scholars are resistant even to go that far and think that, you know, it might have been another character that we're hearing in Shakespeare's sonnets, and not the man himself, but yes, certainly the speaker's feelings.
Yeah. Well, the rap on poets is that they can only write about themselves. And that's true, but is that bad?
No, it's not bad.
But that is the rap, right? They can't. It's very hard for a poet to bring in the outside world into poetry and not filter it through their own sensibility.
I think it's hard to deny that the lyric, you know, which doesn't have to even be in the first person, of course, but we talk about the lyric I oftentimes, and it's hard to deny that the lyric as a genre tends a little bit more toward self-involvement, that it tends to be a more inward genre.
Yeah.
Than drama.
And the danger, of course, is narcissism. But I think a very good poet does something very serviceable, which is to let us see and feel through the speaker's sensibility. That's not narcissism.
No. And that's the hope, and that's the claim of the lyric poet, yeah.
And the disappointment of lovers everywhere, because they don't quite make it to the poems. You know, I was trying to think of exceptions to this rule of poets really only writing about themselves. And the best example I can think of, and I'm sure there are others, but the best example I could think of is Spoon River Anthology by Edgar Lee Masters, which uses a lot of fictional techniques in his series of epitaphs about the little town of Spoon River. Is that a good exception to the rule?
That's a very good exception. And in fact, in the essay, I was really confining the argument to not only love poetry, but especially love poetry that is extended enough over several poems, let's say, or a sequence or a book, that it could potentially turn the other lover into a character, that we have, you know, the poet gives himself or herself enough room to do that, but oftentimes doesn't. But yes, the Spoon River or, you know, the Wessex poems of Thomas Hardy or Gwendolyn Brooks's poems in A Street in Bronzeville, those kind of community portrait poems are definitely a different beast.
But by and large, poets stick to their own selves. Let's see how this works in action in love poetry. And love poetry is broadly defined in your piece. And the first poet you chose a poem from is Jack Gilbert. He's a terrific, underknown poet who died in 2012. The poem you chose is a love/bereavement poem about his wife, Michiko, who died after 11 years of marriage. Anything else you want to say about Jack Gilbert or this poem before we hear it?
No, that's a good introduction. He, as you said, Michiko Nogami was his wife, and she died in her mid-30s. And he wrote a number of elegies for her, the first sequence of which he published in a small chapbook. But he continued writing about her in a number of poems over the course of his career.
So this very short poem is called Married, and our reader here is Cindy Katz.
Married by Jack Gilbert. I came back from the funeral and crawled around the apartment, crying hard, searching for my wife's hair. For 2 months, got them from the drain, from the vacuum cleaner, under the refrigerator, and off the clothes in the closet. But after other Japanese women came, there was no way to be sure which were hers, and I stopped. A year later, repotting Michiko's avocado, I find a long black hair tangled in the dirt.
So we learn from this poem, first of all, that Michiko is dead, and that she had black hair, and that she once potted an avocado plant.
Right.
That's it.
That's it.
But we do have a good sense of the poet, the speaker of the poem, strong feelings for her and his emotional state. What do we learn about the poet's emotional state from this poem?
One thing that always strikes me in this poem is even though the poem as a whole is very sparse and very pared down, in that second line, the emotional nakedness of that simple statement, crying hard, which of course is what you would do after a funeral, but to just put that out there as a kind of matter-of-fact statement. We learn that, you know, we hear a little bit about his grieving process and the collecting of the hair.
For 2 months, got them from the drain, from the vacuum cleaner, under the refrigerator, and off the clothes in the closet.
Such a strange, eerie detail, but it feels so real, you know, as something he seems to be gathering the last traces of her that he can find.
Yeah.
We get the passage of time, the suggestion of possibly other relationships.
But after other Japanese women came, there was no way to be sure which were hers.
Yeah, that's the line that really sticks out. Gilbert must have known the implication of that, which is not just their casual visitors. He's implying that other Japanese women who were lovers came into his house.
Probably. I mean, it's possible that they could also be a family of the deceased, but there seems to be a suggestion that, yeah.
Yeah, he's leaving that in there. I think he's a subtle enough poet to realize that most readers would see that in there. It suggests something very true, which is that you may be grief-stricken over somebody's death, but that doesn't mean your life stops. Everything stops. You can have other relationships and other things go on in your life and still feel very grief-stricken. I thought that was very powerful.
Yeah, and he presents it with the same almost clinical detachment that he presents the fact that he was crying hard and gathering her hair.
And that's what gives the poem a little punch at the end.
A year later, repotting Michiko's avocado, I find a long black hair tangled in the dirt.
It's almost as if that hair, finding the hair, is a reproach for having perhaps forgotten her a little bit and not being so grief-stricken.
That's certainly one way to read it. Another is that he's discovering her anew, discovering his grief all over again. One of the wonderful things about the poem is that it just presents this small series of details and lets us interpret.
Yeah. Now let's turn to a poem by Emily Dickinson that you chose. This kind of surprised me because I'd never think of her as a love poet. This is perhaps her longest lyric, which means it's still not very long. And it's the one that begins, "I cannot live with you." What can you tell us about this poem?
Well, this is one of a number of lyrics that Dickinson writes about a lover figure of some kind or a love interest. With Dickinson, of course, it's hard to say anything definitively.
Yeah.
Or even to say that she's talking about the same figure, you know, from poem to poem. But certainly she has a number of lyrics that present some kind of an impossible love situation or sometimes an unrequited love situation. And this one seems to suggest an impossible love situation, a love that for one reason or another can't happen.
Yeah. It's a wonderful and painful poem in so many ways. Let's hear it. And let's see what we can learn about the beloved along the way. And I may interrupt now and then for clarification. And once again, Cindy Katz is our reader.
I cannot live with you. It would be life, and life is over there, behind the shelf the sexton keeps the key to, putting up our life, his porcelain, like a cup discarded of the housewife, quaint or broke. A newer Sevres pleases, old ones crack.
So she's comparing her relationship to this person to a cracked piece of porcelain that's put away by the sexton as if it's in the back of a church somewhere. She's devaluing her relationship right there.
Yeah, or even her life or our life, you know, the potential life together.
Yeah, and the shocking beginning of the poem, "I cannot live with you, it would be life." That's just the opposite of what most people would probably think. It's almost as if she's saying it's too real.
Yes, it's too real. Life seems to be something that is deferred, you know, or is impossible in certain ways.
Yeah,
fulfillment, at least, yeah.
Okay, let's go on.
I could not die with you, for one must wait to shut the other's gaze down. You could not, and I could I stand by and see you freeze without my right of frost, death's privilege.
So what is she saying there? You can't watch me die. You're not capable of that. And could I actually watch you die without killing myself? Is that what she's asking?
Yeah, that's a good summation. One lover would have to be the one to see the other go. She does seem to think he doesn't have the strength to do that, or she, you know, whomever she's addressing.
Yeah.
And she questions her own strength in that situation, too.
And then we get into a very odd part of the poem.
Nor could I rise with you, because your face would put out Jesus's. That new grace glow plain and foreign on my homesick eye, except that you than he shone closer by.
You're more important to me than Jesus's is.
She is saying that. And she's gone through these stages. I can't live with you. We couldn't die together. I couldn't rise with you either.
They'd judge us. How? For you served heaven, you know, or sought to. I could not. Because you saturated sight, and I had no more eyes for sordid excellence as paradise. And were you lost, I would be, though my name rang loudest on the heavenly fame.
Now she's saying, basically, you are good, and I am not, necessarily.
Yes, even if I were somehow superior in the eyes of God, I would be lost if you were lost. I would be damned if you were damned.
And were you lost, I would be, though my name rang loudest on the heavenly fame. And were you saved, and I condemned to be where you were not, that self were hell to me. So we must meet apart, you there, I here, with just the door ajar that oceans are, and prayer, and that white sustenance, despair.
Now, that's got to be the greatest breakup poem I've ever heard, because...
And it's a breakup poem, and it's not clear that there was ever a relationship.
Yeah. It's a preemptive breakup poem.
Yes.
It's basically saying, I'll embrace distance and despair instead of you. And only Emily Dickinson, I think, could end a poem rhyming prayer with despair.
Yes, that is an extremely characteristic rhyme and thought for her, yeah.
And I guess the poem is making an argument to her lover, or would-be lover, and I want to simplify it in a grotesque way here. It's not you, it's me, and you're too good for me anyway.
That, again, that's one reading. One thing that the poem leaves out is whether there has been, in fact, a relationship, whether this is all in her mind, the potential for a relationship. But for whatever reason, yeah, there's this idea that they can't be together even in the afterlife, right? That they can't be in heaven or hell at the same time. That apartness is the defining characteristic of their relationship.
And what did we learn about him or her or whoever this other person is? What did we learn?
Very little. As you just said, we can't even specify gender. The closest that we get, arguably, to her characterizing the other in this poem is that flat statement, you could not be the one to watch me die, and I possibly could be the one to have the strength to carry on after you left.
Yeah. So what do we learn about Emily Dickinson, or the speaker projected by Emily Dickinson? What do we learn about this person?
We learn something about the moral or religious drama that plays out in her head surrounding this relationship. We learn that life for her is this thing that seems to be deferred or impossible and fulfillment within earthly life. So we learn quite a bit about her temperament, her psychology, and her emotions surrounding this attachment, but very little about the other.
Yeah. So we started by comparing lovers in fiction to lovers in poetry, so maybe we can go back there. Fiction does seem to let in a lot more reality than poetry, but what can poetry do better than fiction?
You know, as I said before, the novel is often... not always, but often a more social form. And we can think of any number of novels, right, that cover the course of a marriage or the course of a relationship and present the partners in that relationship or in that marriage in something like three dimensions, bringing them to life as characters. The lyric is often a more inward form and delves more into the interior reality of one side of a relationship or a love in the case of love poetry. Mm. And in the case of unrequited love poetry, poetry of wanting, of desire on the one hand, or the poetry of loss, grief, post-breakup poems, that kind of thing, the lyric does a wonderful job of capturing that state where you are sort of thrown back on yourself, you know, and on your own psychology and your own inner resources. At those times and in those situations, the other person can seem ghostly, you know, or can seem unavailable, and the lyric does an especially good job of capturing that.
Yeah, it seems like poetry does a much better job solacing our loneliness, our kind of existential loneliness in the world. We identify with a lonely poet in a poem.
I will speak for myself and say yes.
All right. Austin Allen, thanks so much.
Curtis, thank you.
You can read Austin Allen's essay on the Poetry Foundation's website. Just search its title, Immortal Beloved, or search for Austin Allen for that essay and others. Do let us know what you think of this podcast. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.